Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. I am Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse, and I've got my one compadre here. I feel like we're missing part of the three-legged stool, so it's probably going to fall about 10 seconds in. The wheels are falling off. I've got Wade McFall here, retired Assistant Special Agent in Charge from the OIG, and now one of the managers on our SIU investigative team. Matt Kachansky is on a meeting with a client, so he had a conflict. And Jason is still on his extended vacation. He's like the Professor Emeritus. He just takes off, like, you know, months at a time. But it's good to have you here, Wade. It's good to be here with you. So today we want to talk about from a little bit of the provider perspective and some of the things that are out there in the provider world and how that kind of implicates or buttresses up in the SIU space. And we want to talk a little bit about essentially the provider community oftentimes, unfortunately, puts their heads in the sand on things. And, you know, in the general sense, a lot of things that people in the business community do aren't illegal and can do it. Things like referral fees and things like having a you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, a quid pro quo, right? Referring business to each other without an implication, or finder's fees, things of that sort, which really make in the healthcare space, because of the, you know, it's a highly regulated environment. So there are some things out there that I think are going to, you know, that create problems. You know, the one thing that I think we hear a lot from the provider community is this premise of, it's never been a problem, so why is it a problem now? And I know I've had conversations with providers when I'm doing some compliance related work for them. And the question I always ask is it never been a problem because someone other than you and someone other than your circle of friends has said it's not a problem? Meaning, has somebody come in and done a review, an audit? Have you had an investigation? And has someone said, oh, your error rate is zero, or you don't have this problem? Or are you conjuring up that it's not a problem because no one's ever conducted an audit and no one's done a review? And you know, I've said all the time that if providers just did the most basic of compliance, third-party audits, third-party reviews, and gotten some legitimate opinions about things, I think a lot of providers we would have never met in our past lives, because outside of the fraud, from the waste abuse perspective, a lot of providers would have had that. You know, and you see from the SIU perspective now, having been one of our managers for, you know, 4 years now on a lot of projects dealing with the provider community very extensively, I think you'd agree that if providers had some basic auditing functions, where the fox isn't watching the hen house. And I know you see this all the time, where you get a bunch of records, we get them reviewed, we do an overpayment assessment, and then all of a sudden there's these appeals on why it's not a problem. And it's just like, if you had just done some of these basic things, and particularly when you get the provider saying, I don't understand why this is a problem, it's never been a problem before, right? And just some of the steps that providers could take, these basic compliance things, training, education, and proactiveness, right?
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out too, what you're saying is they, with the statement of it's never been a problem before, there's really two options to that. One, it's always been a problem, but you just didn't realize it. Or two, it could be that there's been a change in precedent or regulations could have changed. So it's something that maybe wasn't a problem last year or 5 years ago, but it's a problem now. So it's got to be addressed. And as you pointed out, I think the best way to not have your head in the sand is to have at least a form of what the OIG recommends as a compliance program, which includes, as you said, written standards of conduct, policies and procedures are very important. So they can't say, I didn't know that was something we couldn't do. Compliance training, that's got to be for new employees that come on board. They have to have like a basic set of compliance training that's set out, and then annually everybody has to have it. It can be generally the same thing from year to year, but it should be looked at to be updated in case there are those new things that weren't a problem last year, but they are this year. So right. It can be generally the same training, but it's got to be updated.
Right. We have a technology platform. We have a partner here. We do a lot of technology related training with, where that stuff is updated on a yearly basis. You know, I think the biggest concern is, what if you're actually doing some of that training And then later on, you know, when you say, well, I didn't know that I had to do this. The problem is that, you know, employees sometimes fit a couple of different categories. And sometimes you have a category where you've got a bunch of people that aren't really happy about where they're working, but are working there because of necessity. And so the problem that you don't want to run into is the situation where you say, well, you know, I didn't know any better, or I didn't know the I'm an idiot defense, which always works great for criminal cases. The problem is that where are the bodies buried? And do you have employees who can say, well, no, I took this training, or there's an email, or, you know, I had a conversation about it, where that putting your head in the sand isn't really going to work. That, you know, it's sometimes you wonder if the amount of effort that a provider puts in to not being compliant is less effort than the amount of work that they would need to be compliant. It seems to me that the amount of work that needs to be performed to be compliant is substantially less than the work that you need to cover up that malfeasance.
Yeah, definitely. And I always look at it as if, you know, if OIG comes knocking at your door with a search warrant or an arrest warrant, or just even to ask questions, I think it's very beneficial to be able to show them that you have this program, you do training, as opposed to just like, we don't do any of that. We just haven't gotten around to it. We can't afford it, whatever the excuse may be. I think if you're as like the not the one that's getting pinched, but if you're like the owner of the company or the CEO or something like that, or even a director of some type, if you can show that, look, we take these steps to make sure that they know what they can and can't do. We have a policy set up where they know that they can report things that they see without fear of retaliation, that they, you know, they not only can report it, that if they have a good compliance program, they really have a duty to report if they see something that's going to get the company in trouble. So I think if nothing else, it's for when that day that you hope doesn't happen, but if the, you know, the feds come knocking, you can say, look, this is not the way we operate. We have this training, this whatever, this sales rep that was paying kickbacks or, you know, whatever, we can say we've trained on what the most basic kickback is, for example, but we've also trained on what, you know, are those gray areas that to keep them out of that lane. So as right. long as you can show that you have that proactive training, I think that really goes a long ways and is well worth the money that it costs to do that.
Well, and the proactive training and knowing that you're trying to do the right thing is the thing that'll allow you to potentially skirt the prospect of criminality, right? You do a self-disclosure and things of that sort. But, you know, the thing I always think that's interesting is when providers come to us and say, well, we can't afford to do this. And my two responses are, well, have you ever gotten pricing on what it's going to cost? And then, but really the better question is, how can you afford not to?
Yeah.
You know, it's like preventative maintenance on your car. If by the time you deal with something that's wrong, the cost of fixing that problem could be so substantially more than the preventative maintenance of getting it done. You know, and people think that they have to go through extensive hoops to make some of this happen when they really don't. So it is an interesting piece, which then gets me to the next part, which is as part of that compliance and that other training, you know, we're seeing a real strong uptick on a lot of our projects in our SIU space of record cloning and providers giving us templates and cheat sheets and all that. And, you know, I hate the phrase cheat sheet, although we understand what it really means. It does have kind of a negative connotation. And, you know, oftentimes when I'm talking on the provider side to the billing and coding and the compliance people, and they always say, well, we have these cheat sheets. And it's like, no, you don't. What you have is a coding adjunct, or you have a billing and coding guide. Right. Because you don't want to. It's just sometimes the terminology is what gets you. And particularly in the world of cloning, you know, CMS has some policies out there. Most of the payers have policies with respect to record cloning and the carrying over of something from one visit to another to an extent. Right. It's a little bit of a laziness on the provider. I mean, you see it. You look at these records all the time. You know, how often do you see the 40-year-old female with a history of prostate cancer? And it's not a 40-year-old, it's not a transgender, like we're talking about, it's a, you know, a person who identifies as a female, is a female by gender, by birth, all of that. And it's just the record is just ridiculous. And it's like, you got to be kidding me. And that to me isn't even like a technical violation. That's a laziness. And, you know, come on, like, how could you make that part of any sort of an E&M, right? Medical decision making. Someone saying that they have a 40-year-old woman with a history of prostate cancer, like that, right? That to me is just, that's compliance laziness, right?
Yeah. And the laziness kind of parlays into something I saw a lot of doing these, like investigations of providers during COVID, where they had to record certain things. And granted, you can say that a lot of times the answer is going to be the same, you know, if it's whether or not, you know, whatever it is, a lot of times you're going to have a handful of answers that are going to be the same to certain questions you have to have answered. But the problem is when you can, and like, I'm not a handwriting expert, but I can tell looking through these records after a while, I'm seeing things that look familiar, and I go back and it's like, this is a copy and either a copy and paste or even just like a photocopy of signatures or whatever. It's like, this is not, you know, they would vary a little bit on each one. So it goes back to that laziness of, I don't want to take the step to type it in. And maybe that in itself is not illegal, but the laziness is really what gets them in trouble when they're copy and pasting. Right. They make copy and paste errors, or they're photocopying. They'll do like a sign-in sheet that certain things have to be answered yes or no. They'll photocopy that and then just change it's got the same answer on every sheet, but then they change the member's name and date of birth at the top. Right. It's you're right. It's that laziness that really gets them jammed up.
Well, and to an extent, it's a combination of laziness and a combination of thinking that this isn't important, right? So it's laziness, but then you have to make a proactive decision that you're going to do this. And, you know, what I would tend to think and what I would share with the provider community is that what you think may be an operational efficiency is detrimental to the practice's revenue cycle and compliance health, because the problem becomes that providers, particularly now with the updated E&M guidelines, which it's not, you know, they're not based on documentation, they're based upon that medical decision making. So it's not about, am I spending 30 minutes, 45 minutes, 20 minutes with the provider? It's what's the meat and potatoes of that visit. And the problem is that while you think you're creating an operational efficiency to be able to get the most bang for your time buck, what you're really doing is creating a lack of a culture of compliance, right? It's all about a culture of compliance. On the OIG side, we talk all the time about a culture of compliance. And when you're talking about the DOJ side, it's a culture of corporate citizenship, right? That's the whole point of things like the self-disclosure protocol, the OIG's model compliance guidance, right? DOJ now has a self-disclosure protocol and things of that sort. So it's not so much about creating operational efficiencies so much as it is creating a culture of operational compliance to where we're going to go. The other one that, you know, we've been seeing a lot of is, and this has been going on in the pharmacy space forever, is the waiving of copays and not collecting copays and writing off balances that are on the books from providers as bad debt or something like that. We've been seeing that in the pharmacy space forever, right? Waiving of copays is probably one of the top fraud schemes in the pharmacy space, among other things, particularly when copays could be so large. Now, you know, in an instance where a copay is not that large, a pharmacy may be more willing to just brush it off or make de minimis attempts. But which, you know, you start to see these instances in the provider space, non-pharmacy space, where there's waivers of copays, non-collection of balances due. And, you know, the thing that people need to think about is, while the anti-kickback statute is only applicable to government payers, there are things like, for example, the Travel Act, which became pretty prevalent in the mid late 10s and early 20s, but particularly in the late 2010s. You know, we in New Jersey worked one of the first cases, Biodiagnostic Labs. At the time, it was the biggest kickback case in the country, $50 or $60 million in kickbacks, and they charged a lot of that was under what's known as the Travel Act, which was a prohibition related act involving interstate commerce. So people who thought they were insulated from this, you know, and these things become readily apparent, right? You interview some patients Right? What are people telling you? Because that's a question you're always going to ask.
Yeah, and it goes back to what we were just talking about, not to repeat the same thing, but it's the whole culture of compliance versus the opposite, which is a culture of trying not to get caught. So if you really have that culture of being compliant, and it's not so much like we can get away with this or we'll never get caught, or even if we do get caught, all we'll have to do is pay back the money. It's that whole culture, which is not part of the whole OIG guidance. It's really the compliance culture. And if you you can look at that on a number of different angles, but most of them that are going to get you jammed up are really the culture of not getting caught. Or if we do get caught, it's not going to matter that much. We'll just pay it back.
Right. Well, and then the follow-up question then becomes, well, if you're going to take a shortcut with one thing, what else are you taking shortcuts through? Right. And I think that anybody who thinks that once you're under the hood, you're not checking everything. Right.
Right.
I mean, particularly from an investigative perspective on the SIU or on the OIG side, if we've got your car in the bay for an oil change, we're checking other parts of the car. Right. Because if there's one issue, there may be others. Now, we both know that in a lot of cases, some of the other things that you uncover may not be attractive to a prosecutor or a regulator or something like that. You may find 10 things that the provider is doing that you think are wrong, but somebody may only have an interest in one or two. But I think that it's very simple with some of these, the cheat sheets, the cloning, those are simple strokes of the pen that don't require a lot of process or thought or something along those lines, right? Writing off balances is an easy one. You could say, well, we make 3 attempts and then after that, we just write it off. But if you don't have a solid policy that's been reviewed and vetted by competent consultants and law firms and things of that sort, you're just putting yourself down a path. And always remember, right, a story is only good if one of the people that, if only two people know a story, the only way that it stays secret is if one person's dead, right? Because at some point somebody becomes a malcontent. And so you always have to think from the provider perspective. If you've got someone who's maybe not a happy camper where they're working and they're just looking for that reason, a lot of times people are staying in jobs that they hate, but they're staying in that job because of one reason or another. That doesn't mean that as a malcontent, they're not looking for a reason, right? So you always got to think, look at all the whistleblower cases that are out there are from, you got to be an original source. It's an insider. It's someone who has actionable intelligence that's independent from public record. And so I think, when you start to think about these instances of cheat sheets, cloning records, waiving the co-pays, and whatever else might be going on, there's going to be people that are within that organization that know that. And whether they're close, trusted people who maybe have a bad day and don't want to work for you anymore, right? And those are the people that investigators are hunting down, right? Yeah. They're talking to the employees and former employees becomes part of that metric. Let me ask you, putting your OIG hat on, right? I mean, interviews are a salient piece of any investigative life cycle. SIU investigator, OIG investigator, how often, and I'm not looking for a percentage, but, how often would it be that you're going out to talk to somebody and you're expecting to maybe get like this much information and you leave with, you leave there with your poker face, but in the back of your mind, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe it, right? It's a pretty frequent occurrence.
Yeah, I think it happened a lot with the OIG just because of the type of interview you do. You would show up usually unexpected. So you kind of have them, they don't have time to get their thoughts together on what they're going to lie about. You know that they're going to lie to you. It's just a matter of, are they going to tell you any truths and how much effort is it going to get to that point? But I saw that a lot more with the OIG because of the types of interviews we did in person. We made sure that we had every bit of information that we could possibly know so that we would know when they're lying. And with the SIU work, where I tend to think everything is more remote now and it's a telephone interview and it's just not as effective. I personally didn't come out of any of those interviews saying, oh wow, I know so much more now than I knew before, as opposed to the in-person OIG interview that maybe took an hour or 2 hours, whereas the SIU interviews that I've done personally are very short. A lot of them have to be, a lot of them are, involve a translator, which muddies things up a lot too, because now it's you
right,
not only are you not seeing the person to get their reactions and things of that nature, you're getting the question through a third party. So the comparison between an OIG interview in person and an SIU interview to me is night and day.
Yeah, no, and it can be. And I know, you know, when we did when we've done some of our on-site training, and we've got one coming up actually, and we're doing a block of instruction on interviewing for healthcare, and we talk about some of those challenges of interviewing in a remote environment, right? I mean, I know, you know, you and I had retired by the time COVID was a thing, but we're intrinsically connected up with our OIG friends and family there. And, you know, I know you and I both heard a lot of these stories, because even the OIG was relegated to telephone interviews and Teams and, you know, translators and all of that. So, you know, it's not necessarily different at the OIG during, at least during COVID. It was probably very similar in how you're going to solicit those responses. But it really is a matter of sometimes you just have to keep knocking on the door to eventually get to, you know, where you need to be. So then the last piece I want to talk about, Wade, is because we're, you know, we kind of parlaying from this writing off balances and free services is always this potential thing that's always out there. And whether it be the anti-kickback statute, whether it be Stark, whether it be the more recent statute, ECRA, eliminating kickbacks, and Responsibility Act is the ECRA, is, you know, with labs and things of that sort. And then this whole premise of this quid pro quo amongst healthcare providers of, I'll do this for you, you do this for me, where there's maybe a friendship that's involved, but there can be implications. There's state laws. There may be a violation of something that involves Stark or anti-kickback. What's the value of what you've done? Is there a fair market value assessed to it? But more importantly, the part I want to get from you is, even though some of these things may not be illegal or immoral or unethical, there's always optics. And the problem is that if something looks bad, it's going to cause someone a little bit of grief, and, you know, you're putting yourself unnecessarily in a position that you necessarily shouldn't be in, right? Because optics play an important role in the way that a practice operates.
Yeah, and there are so many exceptions to the kickback rule. You really have to, I think the average healthcare non-attorney really has to get some good advice on if whatever they're doing falls into one of those exceptions, because there are, I think, dozens. I don't think I'm overstating. There's probably dozens of things that normally to an OIG investigator, they look at that and they go, "That we got a kickback case here." But then if they've vetted with an attorney and it's one of those exceptions to the kickback rule, The agent is still going to be looking into, well, this looks and smells like a kickback violation to me, so we're going to look into it. And at that point, as you said earlier, now that the door is open, the car is up on the jacks, they're going to be looking at everything. So if it's something that's that looks kind of sketchy, you want to, for sure, that you have it vetted, so you can be, you know, tell them, you know, we've had this vetted with this attorney, and these are the reasons why we feel it falls into one of the exceptions, and have it all written out.
Yeah, that's an important piece. And, you know, not that I want to go too far off on a tangent on this, but, you know, people, if you're following what's going on with some of the most recent Supreme Court decisions, which, you know, not making this a political statement, but a lot of the justices, when they were being vetted for their positions, talked about stare decisis and settled law. And the most recent iteration of settled law not being settled was the overturning of what is known as the Chevron decision. And without getting very deep into the weeds, it was a 40-year decision that basically said that part of the court's responsibilities would be to defer to agency interpretation of certain rules that may seem ambiguous. Well, in a recent ruling that the Supreme Court just had, and I'm still trying to understand it and interpret it myself, but the basic foundation is that the Supreme Court has said that, no, it's the court's responsibility to provide an interpretation on what might be an ambiguous ruling or a policy or a law. So there's going to be a lot of litigation, we think, definitely in the healthcare space, because you've got LCDs and NCDs. And, LCDs, local coverage determinations, are sometimes considered sub-regulatory guidance. And NCDs are considered regulatory guidance because of the 60-day comment period and all of that. So I think in the healthcare space, the implications are going to be very vast. And the thing is, exactly what you're saying is you've got to have somebody competent to be able to help you with shaping what that's going to be, because the regulatory landscape is changing now on a daily, weekly, minute-by-minute basis. The rules are changing, policies are changing. And that's why having those cheat sheets, so to speak, are not necessarily a bad thing, because you've got to be able to keep up with it. But the thing that's important is that when you're going and relying upon something that's aged, or the premise of it's never been a problem before, so why is it a problem now? Well, are you relying upon things that occurred 5 years ago, right? The fact that the E&M guidelines changed in 21 and there's continue updates on those. Are you even able to rely upon the information that you've got that may be a year or two old? Do you have people on your team that are really up to the minute advised on these things, right? Because people are oftentimes going to speak in historical context and not in real-time context, which is what's really could get you into a pickle.
Yeah. And that again goes back to that, the training that you have yearly that can be generally the same training, but you have to have somebody who's looking for updates that are relevant to whether it's your billing procedures or the codes you use, whatever. But somebody needs to be looking at what's new this year that is different from our training last year to update that, so that cheat sheet that has certain things written on it, some of them were fine last year. Right. And now they're not. So it's a continually, those training manuals and the training, PowerPoints, whatever, have to be like a living document. As we say, they're being updated all the time. Maybe not even yearly. Maybe it should be quarterly.
Right. Yeah, I know from our perspective, we say that compliance plans should be looked at least twice a year. For that exact reason, because of that ever-changing that landscape. The other important piece of the puzzle, and you've mentioned this a number of times, is this training concept. And the reason why that's important is because if a provider does get himself into a pickle, one of the ways that they could potentially work themselves into a little bit of a more favorable situation is to be able to say, hey, look, I have a rogue employee. We've provided training, we've provided education, and this employee still chose to do this. Now, at the end of the day, that doesn't necessarily get you off the hook from an administrative or a civil perspective, but where it can help is this also, some of these recent rulings, particularly with the Supreme Court involving the False Claims Act and this premise of subjective understanding of the rules, that can really help. And if you have a good training and education module in your practice, you can certainly say our subjective understanding was this, and that may go a long way. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff on the provider side that I think oftentimes if providers didn't take the ostrich approach and just put their heads in the sand and not think we don't have the budget to do this, the response really is you don't have the budget to not do it, right? And that becomes a piece of that puzzle. But training, education, communication, and it all gets back to this premise of having people, policies, and technology in place, right? If you have the proper people in place, the proper policies in place, and the proper technology, whatever that may be, and technology is an open-ended discussion, it could just be intellectual technology of people. Those are things that are going to go a long way to help with that compliance that you need. So,
well, you make a good point too about the rogue employee, that if you have the training in place, you're showing that it's not a systematic, it's not all the officers of everybody's in on the same thing. It's like this one person is rogue, and it's not, what's the term we used to use in some of our affidavits? It's not a permeated with fraud. We're like the whole company is fraudulent. It's right. Like we have one, sales rep or whatever, who's, like you said, doesn't want to be here, and he's out doing this stuff. And
right.
That's what the training works against.
And, an important piece of that, which people sometimes tend to forget, is that this extends also to your associate organizations. If you outsource your billing and coding, you really need to have somebody who can go in and do a billing and coding review of them, particularly if you have a third party actually doing the coding for you, or particularly if you have a third party that's doing your billing and having a contingency taking 5% of net receivables. I've seen many instances of billers who had not the best intent or interest in mind when they were doing some of this work. So it really is a piece of the puzzle that I think oftentimes providers sometimes forget, that they've put such a level of trust in their billing company that they tend to put it on autopilot and not think twice about, is my billing department doing anything that they shouldn't be doing? So it's, compliance is a real thing, and it's not to say that you need a full-time compliance officer, but somebody needs to watch the hen house, and it can't be the fox, right? You need to have somebody else to be able to do it. So always good points. I guess we try to always make good points. Otherwise, it would just be two old guys eating chicken wings, drinking beer. So kind of the way it is. But
how many viewers would we have if we're doing that?
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. So Wade, always good to have you. I miss Makachansky this week. I know you do too. I know. I just saw you wiping your eyes before we started the recording. So as always, these are great conversations. We can always keep them going, but we try to keep them, right? It's a podcast. Want to keep it short. So as always, thanks everybody for tuning into this week's OIG Roundtable. We'll call it the abridged version because it's just Wade and I. And as always, you can get our newsletter, which has each week's OIG Roundtable podcast. Get us through our website, adviseadvizehealth.com. You can always send us an email at hello@adviseadvizehealth.com. We've got 3 or 4 LinkedIn Lives that are in the books, ready to go. We've got a great one coming up later this month on lab fraud schemes. We're going to be doing that one. We've got one we're going to be talking about with one of our great nurse auditors here on the differences between auditing and clinical documentation reviews and coding. We've got a lot of great stuff coming up in the next few months, as well as our weekly OIG roundtable. So as always, Wade, it's good to see you. And as always, thanks for tuning into this week's OIG Roundtable. We'll see you on the next one.
Thank you.